While this will be a moderated discussion, I'll be watching the time like a hawk. Audience participation counts for a lot in this panel, so the last 20 minutes is entirely up to you. You can see where the mics are. This session will be recorded, so speak into the microphone. And at 20 minutes, please come and ask your questions when there's 20 minutes on the panel left. I'd like to start off with something. John, last year, you spoke on behalf of Microsoft when IE9 shipped, and we did ask you open questions about the upgrade path, including the fact that it's not available on XP and other things like that. Those questions are still valid, but something interesting has happened in the way that Microsoft is telling its story now. With IE9 out and at large, you're becoming an advocate for user privacy, which I really respect and admire. Privacy is a very big deal. Big web apps are still struggling with this question. Recently, there was a little bit of a doo-doo storm when you talked to Google about not respecting IE's privacy headers. Can you speak to that, please, and tell us what's going on and what your stance on privacy is?
Sure. This really, the incident he's talking about is a post we put on the IE blog that was talking about some practices of Google's around bypassing users' privacy settings. And it was really just a follow-up to a Wall Street Journal article that was done some number of days before that that was talking about how Google was doing that against the privacy settings within the Safari browser, particularly on the iPhone. And talking about that specific incident, all we'll go down is this path of P3P. It's ancient. It's a bad standard. Is that really the important one? And so the specific incident itself isn't really, to me, the primary issue. It's that this particular incident is indicative of a larger problem, namely that users today are not in full control of their privacy when they browse the web. And there are steps being made, such as do not track. But you know, we think that is insufficient. I liken that to putting up a no trespassing sign on your front yard and deciding then that you don't need to lock your door. It's just assuming that everyone else is going to do the right thing. And so one of the things that we've built Internet Explorer and that we're working with and with the community in the W3C is something we call tracking protection lists, which puts that final say, that final action, in the hands of the users, which we feel is very important to let a user actually control their own privacy. There have been places in that discussion in the W3C where there's been some pushback, saying that, well, we should just do the do not track part. The lists, you know, that may be a little bit too far. And we disagree, and we want to keep that moving forward.
Chris, you want to respond?
No, I've been kicking John under the table the whole time, so it's cool. I think that the particular incident, as John already said, like, it highlighted the fact that P3P isn't really the issue, and whatever may happen, I mean, we had this discussion last night where I showed, you know, probably about 6-7 years ago now, when I first rejoined the IE team after a little hiatus, I went down this path of figuring out what P3P was and how it worked in our implementation at the behest of our management chain, because there was some issue that the press was on top of and they wanted to know more about it. And I discovered it was really, really interesting, like, how P3P was set up. It was really intelligent, except it only applied to cookies. And there were already all these other things that people were using to do tracking that were completely independent of it, to the point where people had stopped using cookies for the most part for exactly that reason, because they could get the information some other way and they didn't have to, you know, illegally lie or whatever in their P3P files or anything, their headers. So, P3P is the...
the outmoded platform for privacy preferences.
Yeah. Platform for privacy protections, yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the initial storm was kicked up over P3P, but this is important. Google's Chrome now supports Do Not Track as of about a week ago. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are the web properties on board?
I think so. I mean, I think that everyone, nearly everyone at least at Google, I can't speak for quite everybody at the entire company, believes that users really should be in control of their privacy. They should understand what's going on. And the hard part, of course, is that it's a very complex picture, and it's very hard to understand, even for people who are really clued in, as to what's going on and what's being shared or what isn't. And, like, the big flap about Google consolidating their privacy policies, everybody's like, oh, they're sharing stuff across properties now. Well, no, actually, it turns out we already were, and that was already okay according to the policies. We were trying to simplify it so you can actually read the policy and, you know, understand it as a human being rather than a lawyer bot. So I think that that kind of move to make things easier for people to understand and control is a good thing. There's certainly differences of opinion about how exactly it works, but that's a detail.
I love how you shruggingly make frightening things seem okay. Brendan, did you make a move towards a microphone? Perhaps talk about Do Not Track?
Sure. We pioneered Do Not Track over a year ago, and it's taken off, and it was great to have Google on board. It's a bit of a deathbed conversion, but it's okay. And what I would encourage you to do is there's a Firefox add-on called Collusion. Try running that for a while and see what actually emerges. It's an amazing amount of surveillance. DoubleClick is there, so are other tracking entities. And when I talk to friends at Google, they often talk about the Google properties, but then what about all those DoubleClick cookies? They kind of put those into a separate category. Those are telling Google important things about you if you're not opting out of tracking.
So there's some deeper issues, though. P3P is a way of specifying how your privacy wants to be. It was cut off at the knees by a patent problem 15 years ago. That was really why W3C got involved in patents. But what it gives you now is a very powerful way of specifying a bunch of things about privacy, so powerful that nobody understands it. How many people here have written a P3P policy?
Right. Woo-hoo.
It's a nightmare. It's really complicated. So now we go with this do not track thing. And do not track is fantastic. What does do not track actually mean? It means don't track me, right? Well, exactly how far does that mean you can track me? Because people are still trying to find out about you. Web developers still want to be able to know something about the people who are using their site so that they can offer stuff. One of the reasons for tracking people is because you want to spy on them and dig into what they're doing. And one of the more boring reasons is because you actually want to offer them services that match what they expect. And if you don't have the information about them, then you can't do the kind of personalization they want.
And even more boring than that is simply the concept of identity.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this is a spectrum of usage, and that's been the hard part. And something that P3P tried somewhat with some prescience to do many years ago is try to say, you know, how you're using the data, not just that you're using the data. But that's a very, very fine line to draw, I think.
So let me move on, actually. This is an interesting discussion, and it motivates me to do a little seg into something else. This panel does mention Angry Birds. And we start off talking about privacy, but when we take that one step further to the world of installable web apps and web app stores and stuff like the Chrome Web Store, some interesting questions come about, and I'd like to kind of roll up our sleeves and take a look at those. Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web, recently posted on the public web apps listserv about how he thinks installable web apps are a good thing and should be the next wave of innovation. Ian Hickson, the editor of the HTML5 spec, responded saying that installable web apps are quote-unquote anathema, which is a very nice word, I think about 13 points in Scrabble. It means something very bad, namely that installable web apps are very bad. Charles, Opera has got a lot of thought bits in this space, and real bits. You've pushed the notion of widgets and how a web app should be more than a web app. You've also pushed the notion of how the browser should reach as many devices as possible. So you have bits in this space, and in many ways Opera is the forerunner. What does the game look like? What is the vision that we should have with respect to installable web apps and web app stores?
So the vision is that the web is a platform, right? You build stuff using the web. And you build things that people want. Those things should work. Some of the stuff that people do is connect up to the web, do stuff live, it's all interacting with the network, and then they discover that the network is not working. And in any case, they didn't really need it. What they really wanted to do was deal with some of their own information offline. It makes sense for them to be able to use their applications. The fundamental idea behind web applications that you can install, that you can use without having to send everything to the server, is about users being able to use applications, about developers being able to offer things that work for users. I want to take issue with Hixie's anathema idea. There is an idea around the standards world, around the web world, that the only things that matter for web standards, which means the only things web technology should be interested in, are things you can get to on the public web. You know, if you can't Google it, it doesn't exist and has no right to exist. A position I'd describe as more or less bollocks.
To be fair, there's
a huge amount of stuff that happens behind intranets. And what happens behind your intranet, which is still using a browser, is as much a part of the web as what happens on the public web. So installable web apps, the idea is the same. There's a huge amount of stuff that you could do offline the same platform. Just make it work.
To be fair, Charles, it's not just about finding the app. It's about the URL as the form of installation. That is, you navigate to it because you know how to get to it. That's the rub, is it not? It's not necessarily finding it.
That's not the rub. The URL isn't there as some thing that, you know, makes life easy because people don't sit down and type URLs, you know, hundreds and thousands of them by memory. They use, Google or like Bing or Yandex or something to find the things they want, right? The URL is a very fundamental piece of the web architecture, which lets the machines make sure that you can point to something. But it's not the thing that people use. It's just a way you can make sure you're pointing to the same thing. People use an application. Angry Birds, for example.
Right.
You know, who cares whether their Angry Birds is installed as a web app or running as a web page or installed as a native app on some weird system you never heard of? People who are playing Angry Birds, really, what they want is whatever it is you do, like, you know, shoot stuff at birds.
Whatever it is,
pigs actually.
Right. Okay, so
I'm not a big Angry Birds player.
There's something interesting that should follow that, which is if you think of the notion of installable web apps, you should think of what they're installed onto. And there's been some discussion, you on your blog, Chris, Robert O'Callaghan on his, on what the next wave of competition with the web versus something else should be. And the answer, one of the answers is the mobile stack. Now, Brendan, there's photographic evidence that you sometimes wear a suit. This photo was taken in Barcelona. You were attending the Mobile Web Congress, where you were about to announce something that Mozilla has bet the farm on. A charming idea, which is that the web is the installable app. That is, the web framework is what everything should run within. An idea that's been tried before with WebOS by HP. So
we did up our platform.
Why is Mozilla betting the farm on B2G or Boot to Gecko?
So this is a Galaxy. This is a Samsung Galaxy S2 running Boot to Gecko. Everything here is HTML5 and JavaScript CSS images. Everything on this grid, like the image gallery here, it's all...
This is not a public prototype, correct?
You can pull this off GitHub and build it and flash it onto a rooted Galaxy S2 if you want. Instructions are there. It's your... You web developers, you don't have to run a compiler. There's no Java. There's no Objective-C. It's all web. And the point is, everything here is an application. We cannot have applications that must be connected to the network. Right now, I don't have any network connection. This has to work, and it does. So I agree with Charles that saying that installable web apps are anathema is bollocks. We're betting the farm on this because the web is ready. The web is the platform, and there's no reason, no technical reason in principle or in practice why all those juicy device APIs that have been hogged by the native application stacks on notable platforms cannot be available to the web, and they are available to the web here, and we're standardizing them.
No, we can name the platforms. It's okay.
UIQ.
So Chris.
Please.
Yeah.
To be really clear, I mean, Ian is one person who works for Google, and he has a very particular opinion in the space. That's obviously not representative of the entirety of Google. I mean, we have what's probably arguably the most successful web store for installable web apps today, the Chrome Web Store. And a bunch of us believe very much that having an experience that is based around web applications that have a native application-like experience, that have this seamless user experience. You don't always have to open up a browser and type something into the address bar. Like, I think that's awesome and incredible. I mean, even when I was on the IE team, one of the first things I would do once Chrome was released was install Chrome on a new machine, simply because then I could have a Gmail icon on my desktop that was an app shortcut to Gmail. So I could have something that looked like a native application with no address bar on it from a native Windows icon. Like, that was a powerful experience. It basically replaced the need for a native email app for me to get to my Gmail. And I don't think that generically I would say Google thinks that's anathema or even a bad thing. I think that we all think it's a good thing for the most part. Modulo a couple of people who work for the company.
Last night at dinner, you suggested that you can't even begin to deal with this problem of installable web apps, to take it on head-on, unless you deal with the permissions problem.
I think that is moving to say, forward, that's absolutely true.
No, but let's explain to the audience what we mean by that.
Sure.
The permissions problem, maybe put differently, is how to solicit user interaction so that you know that what the app is about to do is okay. On Android, you have a grant everything forever and it's okay model, where you kind of download it and say it's okay, and then you run it, and it does things whether you know about it or not.
Well,
Brendan decided that this was a
totally
bad model.
True.
Brendan, do you want to speak up to that? And Chris, do you want to respond?
No, hang on. That's not totally true. It's not that you never know. It's that we tell you once when you install the app with a native Android application. It lists in the install page, these are the permissions that this application wants to have access to. So if it wants access to the phone stack, it has to say that. If it wants internet access, it has to say that. And that's one model, right? iOS's model is actually even more like the native application model that we've seen in the past in desktop, where it doesn't even tell you what services that application is going to want to use. It basically just says it's in the super powerful installed app sandbox, where it's not really a sandbox because there's no sand and there's no walls around it.
It got in the store, though.
And there are other models after that, of course. Like, this is a spectrum, and I'm going to hand over to Brendan to describe more of the spectrum, the other end of the spectrum.
Well, so Mozilla is doing a marketplace as well, but we're trying to show that anyone can run an app store or marketplace, that the web is good for discovery, but marketplaces are good for monetization and other kinds of discovery. So we want there to be lots of app stores, and we don't intend for any apps in them to be locked into a particular browser or a vertical silo, like from iTunes all the way down to that shiny hardware Apple makes. Our model is that when you buy stuff, you buy it once. It's attached to your identity, and we have a decentralized identity proposal out called Browser ID or Persona ID. All your stuff is in the cloud somewhere, hanging off your identity. You don't have to keep rebuy it when you switch from Apple to Android. If you go to BootDeGecko, all those apps work just like they should on other modern HTML5 implementations. So how should permissions be handled? I think Android has shown how not to handle them. This has been studied by some friends of ours at UC Berkeley, David Wagner's student, Adrian Porter-Felt. If you look for her homepage, you'll find papers she's written. There are like 57 kinds of permissions. Developers don't understand them. I don't think the Android developers understand them all. They tend to get asked for as a bundle at install time. Most users say yes, and then away you go. It's true that if you get in the Apple Store, you have lots of superpowers, and you're relying on the curation of that store for your security to a great deal. So things like the Path Incident and other apps that are uploading your contacts, these are unpleasant surprises. The model that we're pursuing with BootDeGecko is based on the web. The web tries to follow a principle of least authority. You see this in the same origin policy that's used to keep different sites from messing with each other. If you follow this policy seriously, you usually find that you can weave the granting of permissions into the interaction design without nagging the user, without even asking them an extra question, because the user is generally making a gesture to do something like take a picture or say something to a file. And if you do this well, it's slick and you can make it persistent and you don't have to bundle permissions up front. So that's what we're exploring. I don't think there's a silver bullet here. There are no silver bullets in security, but that's our approach. It's much more conservative and least authority instead of the maximum authority model of other notable platforms.
Okay, thank you for that answer. John, I want to make sure that we ask you a question about Windows. Specifically, since the new programming model takes the idea of an HTML5 app and lets you build an installable Windows app using HTML5. Some would say this is co-option. Some would say this is genius. Over to you.
Sure. So,
co-optive genius?
Thanks, Arun.
Co-option.
So the first thing I'd say is I think there's an interesting distinction between what a lot of people right now are talking about as an installable web app versus a native application. Like in i9, there are pin sites that do much like what Chris was saying, that let you just have a Chrome-less, that's one of my favorite words, a Chrome-less experience. Lets you have a Chrome-less experience and just have that on your taskbar. So next to IE and Outlook, I have Facebook, Twitter, Rotten Tomatoes, Gilt, a bunch of different sites just on my taskbar. Those have no extra permissions, nothing about that app working to show up in my taskbar requires the developer to do something that would make that app not work on another browser. Right? It's completely just added enhancement. The Windows 8 applications built in HTML are different. They're meant to be a native application. And HTML, CSS, and JavaScript is one of the languages that you can use to write one. As a developer, you have that choice. You can use XAML and C#, you can use C++, or you can use HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And so using the word co-opt tends to imply that there is really just a one-way benefit. And certainly, you know, the power of the web and all the effort that's been put into the web platform and that Microsoft has been working on for a long time now certainly helps that Windows platform. But it also goes the other way, too. I went to a talk this morning by a developer on Flipboard who was talking about writing a hybrid app. And, you know, with a slightly cynical perspective, you know, you'd walk away from that saying, that talk told me all the places where the web platform fell over and where I had to move over into native to get the right performance, to get the right capabilities, the right graphics power. We don't believe there should be any limitation to what you can do on the web platform. So when we're investing in making that runtime better, that web platform runtime, sure, it's helping the Windows app platform, but it's also helping the browser, and it's also helping the web. And it's that hardware acceleration that i9 first delivered that we were doing with a look towards Windows 8 and that using that as an app platform that is, I'd say, a big reason why all the browsers up here today have that hardware acceleration.
Native HTML. We're just doing it to make stuff work better.
Do we have native HTML
yet? Speed isn't something that we suddenly started getting excited about last year, actually. You know, people have been working on it for years and years and years because it matters about a whole lot of stuff. I want to back up something Brendan said. One of the things that you could get if you build, you know, 5 different web platforms is some really serious browser wars, right? Where you can't actually shift from one browser to another on your platform, where you're like, you go out and buy a device, and that device defines what browser you've used, yeah. You're locked in like crazy. You're locked in like the bad old days of browser lock-in, and where you have an app store stack on top of that and a pile of browser-specific stuff on top of that, yeah. What you're going to see is some very nasty browser wars and some very nasty lock-in. And that actually concerns me about the model. On the other hand, there are so many benefits to it. There are so many good things about building stuff in HTML, you know, and CSS and JavaScript and whatever the hell else you use, SVG, that it's worth going down this path. It's worth building it. But we the people should be following the trail of breadcrumbs that we the suppliers offer, but we should be looking a little bit at where we're going. Right? Don't get lost in the forest and stuck into one platform because that's where your app is now effectively forced to be.
The tree of forbidden knowledge? The shiny tree?
No. Yeah. Okay, so your use of the word lock-in actually is a good seg to talk about something that's related to this space that I think is a new development, and it's kind of fascinating, which is that recently Google, Microsoft, and Netflix jointly proposed an API that allows content, notably HTML5 video, to be encrypted and decrypted using keys, as well as a new kind of a plugin called a content decryption module. A content decryption module, that's hard to say.
CDM.
Now, CDM, abbreviated CDM. Now, within Google, as you pointed out before, Chris, there are disagreements. Not everybody in Google speaks with one voice.
Absolutely.
One person, namely Ian Hickson, said that this proposal is unethical. Somebody else said, I'm ashamed that Google is participating in this activity. This proposal came from both John and yours organization. I'd like to ask you maybe to don the mantle of Google on your broad shoulders and tell us what this DRM proposal is about and why it's a good idea.
Okay, so this is kind of interesting because for those of you who don't know, I actually spent my first year at Google working on the Google TV team. And I got a lot of experience very directly with the TV market and the content media market as well that really I'm sort of glad to not be quite as directly involved with that anymore. But this is kind of the core of the problem, I think, or the core of the disagreement, because there are a lot of people, and I would, at first I would say that I'm in this group, who just think, you know what, all content protection models ever do is get in my way, and they keep me from moving my iTunes content onto my Android phone or, you know, whatever, like that. I can't grab the content that I own on Amazon and put it on my iPhone or, you know, take it on the plane with me or whatever. It's only streaming available or one of their devices. And so it ends up getting in my way, right? And like The Oatmeal had a great, very well-captured cartoon about this just a couple of weeks ago, where you basically end up going to BitTorrent, right? And I'm actually, that's one stand that I've taken. I don't get content off BitTorrent, but I have plenty of friends who I know do because it's just so much easier for them to do that. Like, they don't have to deal with all this stuff. And that's actually kind of the goal of what Microsoft and Netflix and Google were doing with the CDM proposal, is to make it so that you can have a system that interoperates across vendors to the point where you actually could move content across as long as you can get the CDM for whatever system is in there. So it basically puts the CDM in the hands of the content owners who have the choice of whether to offer the content at all. Like, this is really the key, right? The content authors, the content rights owners, won't put, say, you know, the current season of The Simpsons out there with no content protection. They simply won't do it. They believe that they don't have to do it. And we could take a hard line and just say, well, no, that's the only way you're ever going to get onto a computer. But that's already proven false, right? They already have ways to get out there. They're not pleasant ways. But they think that they're good enough because we can't force them to change their model unless everybody boycotts watching The Simpsons on any kind of form, which unfortunately is hard to organize.
Brendan, did you want to respond or say something about DRM?
Mozilla has always been pragmatic. We're not trying to make free culture be the only culture.
Right.
So we can foresee until some future utopia there will be DRM. But how it gets integrated into the web stack is important. Open source implementations have to be free of encumbrances, so there has to be some kind of plug-in. We don't agree with the current proposal, but I just want to make clear, we're not saying no to DRM. We expect that high-def streaming, high-def content will need some kind of system for rights management and obfuscation. Encryption might be too strong.
I mean, are you actively in that conversation?
We're working in W3C and in the Plugin Futures Group. We're trying to develop the Media Streams proposal that's already being used for advanced audio. We'd like to see that as the basis for something less concrete than what Google and Microsoft and Netflix propose. We want to let a thousand flowers bloom here, but it'd be simpler plugins. These would be just doing the decoding. You know, there are companies that want that data to come down into ARM trust zone memory. You can't even read the pixels out, if you believe that. There's hardware affordances here for DRM. So that's not going to be something that we can touch with a 10-foot pole with open source, but we can see a plug-in model that can support that. And that's what we're exploring.
John?
Yeah. I mean, we want the web to work for people. And that means the people putting the content on the web, and it means the people using the web, and it means the people building the applications that are on the web. And there's, to make that work, you make certain trade-offs, you make certain balances, and figuring out how you do content protection is an important question. And so we got together and worked on a proposal and, you know, put it out there, and we're excited to figure out and get input and feedback and figure out what the right model is.
So we worked on the proposal, right? The proposal came from the TV guys, the web and TV guys, and Opera worked really hard to make that group exist in the first place and to say, you know, if you walk into HTML5 working group in 2009 and say it should be possible to protect content, your bug gets shut down, history tells us, with the highly technical argument, won't fix, DRM is evil. People want to protect their content at some point. People who write apps, want to sell their apps. And to sell them, they want some model where people are more likely to pay the money than just copy them from a friend. It's not just about, you know, the latest Hollywood blockbuster. It's about my stupid fart noise application or my, you know, turn your phone into a vibrator. I want to get my 5 cents from anyone who wants it. So there is some kind of a need. There are lots of concerns. I don't think DRM is evil. But the effects of DRM, you know, as Chris started out saying, the effects of DRM are often evil.
But it's almost like we're working hard to make an inadequate solution because we all know that we can work around it. It's been going on for years.
We are not working to make an inadequate solution. We're trying to deal with the issue of if you get the solution so that it's really, really effective and it does everything and you put it into a society, because technology is not just about, you know, the machine. It's actually about how we, the people, use the machine. If you put it into a world which has really crazy systems for protecting content that don't match reality so that you can't take your own content and put it onto your own device and use it, then you've got a problem. The issues that we've got to look at are actually some of the stuff that Brendan identified, you know, and some of the stuff that Chris said. It's like, the content providers will control the DRM systems you use.
Charles, let me rein you in for a second. I wouldn't have imagined that we'd come to the fifth Browser Wars panel and actually all agree that DRM is going to happen on the web, which is really what it sounds like. It seems like an unavoidable conclusion. Just looking at how we've done this and how our conversations have evolved, we used to, at some point, rail against closed proprietary stacks as being the evil. This used to be Flash or Silverlight. Chris, when you worked at IE, I've beaten you up about Silverlight. I've asked you questions, and you've answered trying to defend the open web. Interestingly, now we have a different set of non-fully integrated technologies that are built under an open source banner. One of those, Brendan, is Dart. You worked on JavaScript all your lifelong days, having invented it and taken it to ECMAScript, and you're still working on the evolution of ECMAScript. Google is proposing things like Dart and Native Client, a plug-in API by any other name. And this comes as interesting developments on the web, and this causes a lot of friction. So why don't you take the gloves off and tell us how you feel about these things?
For me? So actually,
I'm sitting over there.
I took a break from JavaScript to found Mozilla.org and went back in 2005, and we kicked off more work in the standards body, and it's actually going well now. We have everybody on board, I think, except Opera, who dropped out the other year. But there's an awesome team in Munich working on V8 that participates. But a lot of the V8 principals don't like JavaScript, so they went and did Dart. And I understand there's
To be clear, for those in the audience that don't know, Dart is another programming language that's developed at Google, which may be introduced into Chrome, and which may actually supplant JavaScript and may work alongside JavaScript.
Yeah, lots of luck on that one.
So hang on. You have to be really clear about what Dart is. Dart is a programming language. It's also a runtime. And the interesting thing about the programming language is one of the very first things that they said they would always do about Dart is make sure that you could compile it to JavaScript. The JavaScript was a target for it. Now, you can ask the question, like, why would I bother writing anything in Dart then? Right? Because it's going to end up in JavaScript. Why don't I just write in JavaScript to begin with? But the idea is to provide a language that is more suitable for some particular scenarios. I'm not defending Dart scenarios because I'm not on the Dart team or a Dart expert, but that is the goal, is to make sure that it's an option, but one that can still run on other browsers, other environments that don't have the Dart runtime.
Last I looked, there were a lot of gaps, though. There was a test in some code to see if big nums were supported, because in the version of Dart that maps to JavaScript, they aren't. But Dart is another of like 100 languages that compile to JavaScript, and you know on that basis, I'm sure it'll do great, because I don't expect Dart will be supported natively with this runtime Chris mentioned in iOS Safari ever. And the attempt to get support for Dart into WebKit bounced off WebKit Dev the other month. And for good reason. I think some of the Apple guys made some good technical points about the cost in garbage collector overhead. So what I see here is partly there are people at Google who have strong opinions about programming languages, and they're senior, and they want to show what they can do. And I think maybe as a retention package or to see if they can actually realize some savings for Googlers, they're doing it. But I don't think it's going to do well. It's not going to cross the chasm to other browsers. I have friends at Google who also think it's going to be a $100 million folly, that it's not going to stick. It's not going to replace JavaScript. I myself am agnostic. I'm looking for good ideas to put into the ECMA committee so that we don't get stuck in the usual committee paralysis. We seem to be making progress. Dart was a little late in providing input for the sixth edition that we're working on now, but we're trying to track it and learn from it. So yay, Dart.
So, and if I may.
Please, Chris.
If that's all that Dart ever does is provides input and helps come up with good ideas and expands JavaScript, I think that Google would consider that a success.
Yeah, like that leaked memo said.
Would you leave it in the browser?
Pardon?
Would you leave it and put it in a stable channel of Chrome and leave it there?
Well, I think we would probably put it in the stable channel of Chrome. Would we leave it there in the end if no one's using it? Of course not. Do you still ship VBScript?
Yeah.
So do you
I'm
still...
Sorry. I'm so glad.
To take the question another way, Chris.
I mean, we turned it off at one point, didn't we?
Yeah, I think it was off.
So to take the question another way, do we get stuck implementing dash WebKit prefixes in CSS? And it's like, yes, we do. No, I'm following up the same question with another example. What you do with Dart impacts the world the same way as what we have with the dash WebKit prefix stuff, where you build something, you let it out, and you say, well, here's a way to bust up interoperability. What are we going to do?
Except that,
push it out into the web and make it work.
So I'm going to have to go all moderator on you guys.
Come on.
All right. Okay. No, look.
John, you're in a great position here.
No, the vendor prefixing question is interesting. I don't quite follow your train of thought from JavaScript to vendor prefixing. However, that we will discuss that.
I think they're related. I think actually I would say flip it around and let's talk about vendor prefixing. And I think that our policy, if you will, for whether Dart would get removed in the future would be pretty much the same. Right?
So it's usage related.
It's whether people are actually using it
or not. So I want to make sure the audience understands what vendor prefixing is, first. John, hang on to that thought for just a second. I'll get right back to you. In CSS, for those of you that write CSS, there are certain things that only work in Safari or in the WebKit combine. That is the two browsers.
How many people know what the dash WebKit prefix means?
Yeah, everybody knows what it is.
Good.
Yeah, don't blame it.
This also makes its way into APIs, and that's what we're talking about.
And the DOM. Yeah. It's exposed that way.
So the place where I see the connection that I think Charles is trying to make is that a lot of the problem that happens that we're starting to see with vendor prefixes happens when a browser ships a feature that's not interoperable, in other words, proprietary, in their stable version, and developers can take a dependency on it. And once they take a dependency on it, it's totally reasonable to say, well, I don't want to remove this because then I'm going to break all these developers. Right? And so that's why when there is something like Dart, I think that's a great experimentation to keep in the beta channel, right? And to get feedback and help provide ideas into the ECMAScript, into TC39, and to make progress that way. But once you put it out there, there will be developers. I mean, the people in this room, we're kind of inside the beltway in the browser world, right? There are tons of developers out there who really don't want to spend their time thinking about you know, exactly what one browser is doing versus the next, or what standards body is doing in the next. So they're just going to use what's in the platform. And when that happens, then you end up with problems like a mobile web that only works on WebKit. And you end up with, you know, applications like the Amazon Cloud Reader that will never work in Firefox or IE because they use WebSQL, which is a dead standard. We all agree on it. We're all building the alternative. But, you know, the fact that it's there, people will just start to take a dependency on it.
Can you imagine if we all had to add our own programming languages, Apple would do something called Flechette. It would be very sleek. And Microsoft would do something big, Javelin, right? It would be not Dart, but Javelin.
Catapult.
Mozilla would do something. We would do like Nerf Dart or something.
Nerf. I promised that the remaining 20 minutes would be over to you guys, and we are at that mark. So there's somebody already lining up at the microphone. Over to you.
Is this on? Yeah, it is. So I wanted to talk a little bit about DRM and politics in the United States and how that's going to impact the distribution of media around the world. Right now, the film lobby in the United States has caused regions throughout the world. So if I buy a DVD in France, I can watch it once on my computer when I switch to, you know, code 2 and then back to 1 for the United States. It might not impact most of the people in this room if we're all from the USA, but it's impacting the rest of the world. And my fear is that if we have a spec on DRM, that it's really going to be basically pulled into media and the lobbyists, and
sure.
It's going to, if you guys could comment on that.
There is a real fear, I think. Henry Sivanen from Mozilla has articulated it pretty clearly, that the question of, right now, the proposal doesn't say anything about what the CDM is, right? You have this plugin, which today is controlled by the content providers. And when the content providers decide that, you know, we've got this content and we're using our decryption module, you have to have our decryption module to watch our content, then they're in an interesting position of saying, you know, if they happen to have a browser as well, and they say, well, turns out that our decryption module works really well on our preferred devices and our preferred browser, and it doesn't really work so well on anyone else's, then, yeah, it's not just about regions, which are another thing. It's about devices. It's about OS. It's about, you know, there is a risk of being really locked in hard to people who say, well, you've got to buy, you know, all of our Kool-Aid. You've got to have an iMac and an iPhone and an iTab, and iTunes, and iMovies, and iEverything, or you're not going to play Angry Birds or watch, I don't know, whatever people want to watch, The Simpsons. South Park is my preferred choice. I'm very tasteless. But, yeah, there is a really big risk in that. And one of the, you know, what I tried to say before Arun cut me off, DRM is not evil, but implementations very often do evil by not being well enough thought through. And I agree with you. That's a serious issue. We really need to look at that carefully as we're putting this stuff in. Yeah, yeah, it's coming. You can't avoid DRM, right? You can't avoid having it brought to the web. But how it comes, what we do as developers, what we choose as users, how we vote with our feet and our wallets and our coding time is going to make a big difference.
So one
and politics
of the,
plays into it.
One of the principles of the internet architecture is the end-to-end principle. It says that you can communicate with any computer anywhere. It has an IP address. You don't care what kind of operating system it's running. If you have your stuff somehow associated with it and you really bought it, it ought to be portable. And that's one of the things Mozilla is pushing. We don't want to make it likely that DRM becomes tied to hardware or tied to a certain vertical silo. So I agree with the concern.
So I've been writing both Windows and web applications for about 12 years now. And when I build concepts, I'll often build concepts in whatever's on Windows and then write the production version on web because I have to write a different version for each of your browsers. And I like to push the envelope as much as possible. I do stuff in SVG and VML with Raphael and stuff like that. My question is, as someone who loves WPF and would love my web experience to feel the same as, you know, like writing some XAML and then writing some custom code in the back end to to do stuff. Does the W3C have any sort of teeth at all? Because I've always expected them to be the ones that said, okay, well, here's the standard, and I need you guys to fulfill that standard. And it doesn't seem to work that way, and I have no understanding on how that dialogue works between you guys and them.
Is the primary question about, like, how do we get to the place where the same code really does run the same way across all browsers?
I'm less concerned about that and more concerned about looking at a mobile developer, and he shows me this game he wrote, and me saying, I could do that in the browser in the same amount of time it took you, instead of saying, I could do that, but it'll take me 6 months.
So the W3C police will be knocking on your door early this morning.
No, they
don't have any teeth, right? Okay. The teeth they have is us, the community, mm-hmm. right? W3C lays out the pathway, and we can choose to follow it, or we can choose to go down any particular path we want to. What W3C does, it's a place where we all sit down and say, well, here's ways we think we can make this stuff more interoperable, because we think that, on balance, people like that. Mm-hmm. But no, actually, you know, Doug Shepard sitting over there is the W3C police, so beat him up after the session.
Yeah, you're supposed to beat him up, I think.
I think part of the challenge is this kind of idea between making something work the same way across all browsers and innovating in the web platform as fast as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where you end up with some of the tensions around things like a Dart, right, and the WebKit prefixes. You know, Apple had a need to have a bunch of those properties and things in their platform for iTunes back in the day, mm-hmm. and it put those in the web. And many years later, it's kind of left us with a little bit of a problem, but it did push the envelope. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to manage this place where we can move as fast as we can while still making sure that we're maintaining the principles of interoperability and making sure the same thing works everywhere.
I think the W3C CSS working group should have standardized a lot of those WebKit properties promptly. I think that was a failure of that standards group, not of developers or of Apple in particular.
Well, I mean, Apple's failure there was simply not proposing them.
There have been,
or even documenting them well.
All right, I'm going to defend Apple slightly, but you're right. Apple's done things that aren't good for the web, open web either, but those became de facto standards, and other entities reverse engineered a lot of them. And
of course, I'm not saying that was a purposeful evil. Just
next question.
Oh, hi.
Hey, Jeremy.
I'm seeing a pattern here, and I think you were alluding to it, Charles, which is you have a situation like DRM, content providers want DRM. So there's a proposal. Now, the proposal is imperfect or stupid or bad, but at least it kicks off the discussion about what are we going to do about video on the web and content providers. Or you have a situation, and it's a scripting language in the browser, and there's a batshit crazy idea like Dart that's put out there that has no chance in hell of ever succeeding, but it, as you said, it does actually feed into what ECMAScript might look like. And as Chris said, if that's the only thing it does, you know, that's actually kind of positive. So you got a situation like WebKit prefixes being fairly ubiquitous. So there's a batshit crazy proposal from Mozilla and Opera and Microsoft that, hey, why don't we support WebKit prefixes? Are you really doing it with the intention that you think it'll solve the problem, or is it more this is getting the problem out there so that we as developers are confronted with what we've done wrong, the W3C is confronted with what they've gone wrong, right? They've been too slow. That is it more about the kerfuffle than the actual proposed solution?
We did not do that WebKit prefix proposal or initiation in the W3C CSS working group. We didn't do that just to provoke some kind of kerfuffle that would lead to some better standards down the road. We actually are thinking about supporting certain WebKit prefixes if there's nothing else that's going to make the page
work. And do you think that's the solution that will solve the problem?
It's a dirty hack.
I don't like it.
The few prefixes that we take, it's a dirty hack that will more or less solve the big problem we're seeing right now. There is another problem which it won't solve, which is developers are picking up experimental stuff and putting it into production systems that they're not going to change for 25 years because, you know, they say, here's a prototype, and the marketing guy says, great, I love it, and the business guy says, right, you're not working on that anymore ever again.
Right.
So that problem needs to be solved
And will that problem not be solved by the proposal itself? In other words, the kerfuffle that's been kicked off is already solving that problem.
There are two things we need to do. We need to get rid of the prefixes so that we have standardized animations, transitions, transforms, and so on. And that's happening. It needs to happen very quickly. It should have happened years ago. But even if we do that, the playing field is so tilted that it's impossible to gain market share if you're served mobile content if you don't emulate some of these things. It isn't just a matter of not looking right. It's unreadable. Text size adjust is another good example. So we're going to try to do both. We're going to try to do as little as possible of the emulation. But we had to reverse engineer undetected document.all and inner HTML. This was years before HTML5. Those were actually, I think, things that could have been standardized in the 90s, and probably some of them should have been. And apart from the lack of a vendor prefix, what's the problem? So when there is a vendor prefix, I say, what's in a rose, right? What's in a name? A rose by any other name smells as sweet. WebKit smells sweet if it works right, if developers like it. I don't fault the developers for liking it.
Yeah, the problem's got like six heads, and us implementing some dash WebKit prefixes chops off one of the heads, but the other five are still there. And we still need to solve them. W3C needs to work more efficiently. We need ways of making sure that when you put up some dash WebKit thing that is undocumented and people start liking it, we say, hey, people might actually use that. Let's figure out a way of getting it documented and standardized faster. W3C needs to solve that. The people developing, us, Apple, Microsoft, all the people on this table, need to participate, need to actually come along in good faith and say, we're trying to build this platform, let's make sure we're not forking the platform into lots of little temporary sidetracks so that we can get a temporary advantage to twist the market a bit in our favor. We need to solve the problem of developers understanding what things are for use in their new showcase of what they can do and what things are for use in the tax department's website.
I agree entirely. Plus the W3C one. Removing too slow. The browsers, didn't put stuff forward for standardization fast enough. Web developers were implementing experimental features as though they were setting stone. That's the problem. That problem is being addressed by the discussion around the batshit crazy idea of implementing one browser implementing another browser's vendor prefixes. Because if you go ahead and do that, and we're going to be in the VB script situation, because once it's in there, it's not coming out.
Sharing is caring.
We are in the situation where you looked at the problem, you said something must be done, implementing another browser's vendor prefixes is doing something has been done, regardless of whether it's actually going to fix the problem.
Most of these are fine CSS extensions.
Sharing is caring. Other people at the mic, please.
Oh, that's what you meant by sharing is caring.
Hi. I have a question about security in a shared environment, which actually the Boot2Gecko guys are probably dealing with a lot. But for ECMAScript code in general, as they get more app-like, I'm curious if the next version of ECMAScript is going to have the controls we need to correctly hide and encapsulate different components so that they can work together without danger, or how you guys are dealing with that. I know there's Google Caja. I know the iframe had sandboxing proposed. What do you think is going to be the future for that?
The HTML5 spec actually talks about this with the window proxy in the window. The same origin policy relies on this kind of capability wrapper. Mm-hmm. So proxies are in ES6. They're prototyped in V8 and Firefox, and SpiderMonkey and Firefox. They're a useful tool for building security machinery that wraps things and can do pervasive mediation. You can do revocable capabilities with them. That's one of the important tools that's already built into the machinery of the web with this window proxy thing. This, when you get your hands on some other window or iframe, you're not really talking about this inner scope object, you're talking about some outer proxy. We just make that part of the language so you can now use it freely. So Caja and other such systems, really secure ECMAScript, use proxies to good effect. And it's, as with any security system, there's no silver bullet. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. This just gives you finer grain control and more pervasive mediation.
Thanks.
Hi there, and this segues in very nicely from the previous question, perhaps overlaps a little bit too much. I was going to ask about the same origin policy also, because I think there's a lot of developers now who want to be able to bring in content from other domains, and unfortunately the single origin policy, while it's very well intended, it causes some difficulties, and the workarounds that are available feel kind of hacky, like using iframes and playing some wizardry with those, and then JSONP, while it works very nicely, is also it brings its own set of challenges and requires you to completely and utterly trust another domain. And going down from that, there's Flash, which really just kind of reaches into another dimension entirely and says, this is what I want to do.
We looked at,
so you have CORS, which CORS is designed to give a partial solution. The same origin policy is there because security is complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Throwing it away is not going to be a good solution. What we see from the DRM discussion, what we see from the privacy discussion, from the permissions discussion, users need to understand what they're giving away, because if they don't get it, they'll give everything away. And we, the browsers, are not really in a position to say, well, we'll give you a do not trespass sign, but we're going to take away the lock on your front door. It's like, we're just not going to do that. So we recognize the problem. Mm-hmm. And CORS is, you know, one big piece of work that's recently come into the whole platform of browsers to alleviate it. It's not, you find in the installed application environment some more experimentation, some more looking at solutions, but it's not easy because it's, you know, do you really want to go around ripping people's locks off before you find out what's going to happen afterwards?
I completely agree, and I agree it's a very complicated subject. There was one specific thing I was wondering if there's any hope of ever coming back, and I'm guessing since it seems to have been abandoned that there was a good reason for getting rid of it, and that was ex-domain headers. Those didn't seem to be very well supported cross-browser, and so we didn't really experiment with them very much, but it seemed like if the server could specify other domains on the initial loading of the page, that it would be a relatively easy and perhaps secure way to say that I want to allow content from these domains but not others.
That's a feed into CORS, right? It's a precursor to what CORS does.
Yeah.
Okay.
You should be able to use CORS, we hope. Yeah. But CORS isn't the last word. This is going to continue, but we're evolving from a, we believe, secure and somewhat restrictive model, and we're going to do it carefully.
Okay, thank you very much.
There is another point, which is, you know, yes, you can go into Flash and break the security model, but it's like, that is, you guys are just ripping the doors off people's buildings. It's not necessarily a good thing to do, either.
No Flash on mobile.
Hi there. I think this question has been asked twice already, but I don't think it's much about the web app, but the thing that your browsers are not following one standard. So for us as developers, we end up with 1,000 lines of code instead of 200. So I just wanted to ask when. I mean, I know you're not going to give me the answer right now, but to get a consortium, the W3C, that really works and puts the standards for us to actually create an efficient code cross-browser.
It'll be on a Tuesday. That's press release day at W3C.
It's not up to the W3C. It's really up to the best thing for interoperation has been competition in the last 8 years, right? Since we launched Firefox. Competition is what's driven various parties back to the standards bodies and had them working more productively. Even though we get shenanigans like Dart or whatever, we also get a lot of cooperation in the standards bodies.
Last question. Let's make sure we allow the last question.
In the future, we will lose Silverlight and Flash probably for video. Who will support MPEG Dash?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last.
You have to raise the mic.
Who will support MPEG Dash? I know Microsoft will, but what about the others?
I don't know if we'll support MPEG Dash specifically as the final decision of the platform, but adaptive streaming, that Dash does, that functionality is definitely on the way. Everybody needs it, and it's really clear that we're going to be doing it one way or another. Whether it ends up being MPEG Dash means you've got to work with MPEG, or Apple's adaptive streaming means you've got to talk to Apple, which we'd love to be doing today. Adaptive streaming will be there. And there are lots of ways to do it. So it's a question of finding the one that we can all agree on and make it work. Yeah. And you guys putting the pressure on and saying, we need this. Make it work.
We need it.
Cross-browser, cross-device.
All right, great. We are now at time. Thank you so much for coming to this. If you like this panel... please upvote it so that next time we can get a bigger room and allow more people in. Thank you.